The Scarlet Plague by Jack London, originally published in 1912. Chapter 1. The way led along upon what had once been the embankment of a railroad, but no train had run upon it for many years. The forest on either side swelled up the slopes of the embankment and crested across it in a green wave of trees and bushes. The trail was as narrow as a man's body and was no more than a wild animal runaway. Occasionally, a piece of rusty iron showing through the forest mould advertised that the rail and the ties still remained. In one place, a 10-inch tree, bursting through at a connection, had lifted the end of a rail clearly into view. The tie had evidently followed the rail, held to it by the spike, long enough for its bed to be filled with gravel and rotten leaves, so that now the crumbling, rotten timber thrust itself up at a curious slant. Old as the road was, it was manifest that it had been of the monorail type. An old man and a boy travelled along this runway. They moved slowly, for the old man was very old. A touch of palsy made his movements tremulous, and he leaned heavily upon his staff. A rude skull cap of goatskin protected his head from the sun. From beneath this fell a scant fringe of stained and dirty white hair. A visor, ingeniously made from a large leaf, shielded his eyes, and from under this he peered at the way of his feet on the trail. His beard, which should have been snow white, but which showed the same weather wear and camp stain as his hair, fell nearly to his waist in a great tangled mess. About his chest and shoulders hung a single, mangy garment of goatskin. His arms and legs, weathered and skinny, betokened extreme age, as well as did their sunburn and scars and scratches betoken long years of exposure to the elements. The boy, who led the way, checking the eagerness of his muscles to the slow progress of the elder, unlike wore a single garment, a ragged-edged piece of bearskin, with a hole in the middle through which he had thrust his head. He could not have been more than 12 years old. Tucked coquettish over one ear was the freshly severed tail of a pig. In one hand he carried a medium-sized bow and an arrow. On his back was a quiver full of arrows. From a sheath hanging about his neck on a thong projected the battered handle of a hunting knife. He was as brown as a berry and walked softly, with almost a cat-like tread. In marked contrast with his sunburned skin were his eyes. Blue, deep blue, but keen and sharp as a pair of gimlets. They seemed to bore into the aft about him in a way that was habitual. As he went along, he smelled things as well. His distended, quivering nostrils carrying to his brain an endless series of messages from the outside world. Also, his hearing was acute and had been so trained that it operated automatically. Without conscious effort, he heard all the slight sounds in the apparent quiet, heard and differentiated and classified these sounds. Whether they were of the wind rustling the leaves, of the humming of bees and gnats, of the distant rumble of the sea that drifted to him only in lulls, or of the gopher, just under his foot, shoving a pouch full of earth into the entrance of its hole. Suddenly, he became alertly tense. Sound, sight, and odour had given him a simultaneous warning. His hand went back to the old man, touching him, and the pair stood still. Ahead, at one side of the top of the embankment, arose a crackling sound, and the boy's gaze was fixed on the top of the agitated bushes. Then, a large bear, a grizzly, crashed into view and likewise stopped abruptly at the sight of the humans. He did not like them and growled curiously. Slowly, the boy fitted an arrow to the bow and slowly he pulled the bowstring taut. But he never removed his eyes from the bear. The old man peered from under his green leaf at the danger and stood as quietly as the boy. For a few seconds, this mutual scrutinizing went on. Then, the bear betraying a growing irritability, the boy, with a movement of his head, indicated that the old man must step aside from the trail and go down the embankment. The boy followed, going backward, still holding the bow taut and ready. They waited till a crashing among the bushes from the opposite side of the embankment told them that the bear had gone on. The boy grinned as he led back to the trail. "A big gun, grandsir," he chuckled. The old man shook his head. "They get thicker every day," he complained in a thin, undependable falsetto. "Would have thought I'd live to see a time when a man would be afraid of his life on the way to the cliff house. When I was a boy, Edwin, Men and women and little babies used to come out here from San Francisco by tens of thousands on a nice day. And there weren't any bears then. No, sir. They used to pay money to look at them in cages. They were that rare. What is money, grand sir? Before the old man could answer, the boy recollected and triumphantly shoved his hand into a pouch under his bearskin and pulled forth a battered and tarnished silver dollar. The man's eyes glistened as he held the coin close to him. I can't see, he muttered. You look and see if you can make out the date. Edwin, the boy laughed. You're a great grand sir, he cried delightedly, always making believe them little marks mean something. The old man manifested an accustomed chagrin as he brought the coin back again close to his own eyes. 2012. He shrilled and then fell to the cackling grotesquely. That was the year Morgan V was appointed President of the United States by the Board of Magnates. It must have been one of the last coins minted, for the Scarlet Death came in 2013. Lord, Lord, think of it. 60 years ago, and I'm the only person alive today that lived in those times. Where did you find it, Edwin? The boy, who had been regarding him with the tolerant curiousness one accords to the prattlings of the feeble-minded, answered promptly, I got it off a hoo-hoo. He found it when he was herding goats down near San Jose last spring. Hoo-hoo said it was money? Aren't you hungry, Grandsire? The ancient caught his staff in a tighter grip and urged along the trail, his eyes shining greedily. I hope Harlips found a crab or two, he mumbled. They're good eating, crabs. Might good eating when you have no more teeth and you've got grandsons that love their old grandsire and make a point of catching crabs for him. When I was a boy, but Edwin, suddenly stopped by what he saw, was drawing the bowstring on a fitted arrow. He had paused on the brink of a crevasse in the embankment. An ancient culvert here had washed out, and the stream, no longer confined, had cut a passage through the fill. On the opposite side, the end of a rail projected and overhung. It showed rustily through the creeping vines which had overran it. Beyond, crouching by a bush, a rabbit looked across at him in trembling hesitancy. Fully 50 feet was the distance, but the arrow flashed true, and the transfixed rabbit, crying out in sudden fright and hurt, struggled painfully away into the brush. The boy himself was a flash of brown skin and flying fur as he bounded down the steep wall of the gap and up the other side. His lean muscles were spring of steel that released into graceful and efficient action. 100 feet beyond, in a tangle of bushes, he overtook the wounded creature, knocked its head on a convenient tree trunk, and turned it over to Grandsire to carry. Rabbit is good, very good, the ancient quavered, but when it comes to a toothsome delicacy, I prefer crab. When I was a boy, why do you say so much that ain't got no sense? Edward impatiently interrupted the other's threatened garrulousness. The boy did not exactly utter these words, but something that remotely resembled them, and that was more guttural and explosive, and economical of qualifying phrases. His speech showed distant kinship with that of the old man, and the latter's speech was approximately an English that had gone through a bath of corrupted usage. What I want to know, Edwin continued, is why you call crab toothsome delicacy. Crab is crab, ain't it? No one never heard calls it such funny things. The old man sighed but did not answer, and they moved on in silence. The surf grew suddenly louder, and they emerged from the forest upon a stretch of sand dunes bordering the sea. A few goats were browsing among the sandy hillocks, and a skin-clad boy, aided by a wolfish-looking dog that was only faintly reminiscent of a collie, was watching them. Mingled with the roar of the surf was a continuous, deep-throated barking or bellowing, which came from a cluster of jagged rocks 100 yards out from shore. Here, huge sea lions hauled themselves up to lie in the sun or battle with one another. In the immediate foreground arose the smoke of a fire, tended by a third savage-looking boy. Crouched near him were several wolfish dogs similar to the one that guarded the goats. The old man accelerated his pace, sniffing eagerly as he neared the fire. Mussels, he muttered ecstatically. Mussels! And ain't that a crab? Hoo-hoo! Ain't that a crab? My, my, you boys are good to your old grandsire. Hoo-hoo, who was apparently of the same age as Edwin, grinned. All you want, grandsire. I got 4. The old man's palsied eagerness was pitiful. Sitting down in the sand as quickly as his stiff limbs would let him, he poked a large rock mussel from out of the coals. The heat had forced its shell apart, and the meat, salmon-coloured, was thoroughly cooked. Between thumb and forefinger, in trembling haste, he caught the morsel and carried it to his mouth, but it was too hot, and the next moment was violently ejected. The old man spluttered with the pain, and tears ran out of his eyes and down his cheeks. The boys were true savages, possessing only the cruel humour of the savage. To them, the incident was excruciatingly funny, and they burst into loud laughter. Hoo-hoo danced up and down, while Edwin rolled gleefully on the ground. The boy with the goats came running to join in the fun. "Set him to cool, Edwin, set him to cool," the old man besought in the midst of his grief, making no attempt to wipe away the tears that still flowed from his eyes. "And cool a crab, Edwin, too. You know your grandsire likes crabs." From the coals arose a great sizzling, then proceeded from the many mussels bursting open their shells and exuding their moisture. They were large shellfish, running from 3 to 6 inches in length. The boys racked them out with sticks and placed them on a large piece of driftwood to cool. "When I was a boy, we did not laugh at our elders. We respected them." The boys took no notice, and Grancier continued to babble an incoherent flow of complaint and censure. But this time, he was more careful. He did not burn his mouth. All began to eat, using nothing but their hands and making loud mouth noises and lip smackings. The third boy, who was called Hare Lip, slyly deposited a pinch of sand on the mussel the ancient was carrying to his mouth, and when the grit of it bit into the old fellow's mucous membrane and gums, the laughter was again uproarious. He was unaware that a joke had been played on him, and spluttered and splat and spat until Edwin, relenting, gave him a gourd of fresh water with which to wash out his mouth. "Where's them crabs, Hoo-Hoo?" Edwin demanded. "Grancier's set upon having a snack." Again, Grancier's eyes burned with greediness as a large crab was handed to him. It was a shell with legs and all complete, but the meat had long since departed. With shaky fingers and babblings of anticipation, the old man broke off a leg and found it filled with emptiness. "The crabs, ho ho," he wailed. "The crabs! I was fooling Grancier. They ate no crabs. I never found one." The boys were overwhelmed with delight at sight of the tears of senile disappointment that dribbled down the old man's cheeks. Then, unnoticed, Hoo Hoo replaced the empty shell with a fresh cooked crab. Already dismembered from the cracked legs, the white meat sent forth a small cloud of savoury steam. This attracted the old man's nostrils, and he looked down in amazement. The change of his mood to one of joy was immediate. He snuffled and muttered and mumbled, making almost a croon of delight, and as he began to eat. Of this, the boys took little notice, for it was an accustomed spectacle, nor did they notice his occasional exclamations and utterances of phrases which meant nothing to them, as, for instance, when he smacked his lips and chomped his gums while muttering, "Mayonnaise! Just think, mayonnaise!" And it's 60 years since the last was ever made, 2 generations, and never a smell of it. Why, in those days it was served in every restaurant with crab. When he could eat no more, the old man sighed, wiped his hands on his naked legs, and gazed out over the sea. With the content of a full stomach, he waxed reminiscent. "To think of it, I've seen this beach alive with men, women, and children on a pleasant Sunday, and there weren't any bears to eat them up either. And right up there on the cliff was a big restaurant where you could get anything you wanted to eat. 4 million people lived in San Francisco then. And now, in the whole city and country, there aren't 40 all told. And out there on the sea were ships. And ships always to be seen. Going in for the Golden Gate or coming out. And airships in the air. Dirigibles and flying machines. They could travel 200 miles an hour. The mail contracts with the New York and San Francisco Limited demanded that for the minimum. There was a chap, a Frenchman, I forgot his name, who succeeded in making 300, but the thing was risky, too risky for conservative persons. But he was on the right claw, and he could have managed it if he hadn't been for the Great Plague. When I was a boy, there were men alive who remembered the coming of the first aeroplanes, and now I have lived to see the last of them. And that 60 years ago. The old man babbled on, unheeded by the boys, who were long accustomed to his garrulousness, and whose vocabularies, besides, lacked a greater portion of the words he used. It was noticeable that in these rambling soliloquies, his English seemed to recrudesce into better construction and phraseology. But when he talked directly with the boys, it lapsed, largely, into their own uncouth and simpler forms. But there weren't many crabs in those days, the old man wandered on. They were fished out, and they were great delicacies. The open season was only a month long, too. And now, crabs are accessible the whole year round. Think of it, catching all the crabs you want, anytime you want, in the surf of the Cliff House beach. A sudden commotion among the goats brought the boys to their feet. The dog about the fire rushed to join their snarling fellow who guarded the goats. While the goats themselves stampeded in the direction of their human protectors, a half dozen forms, lean and grey, glided about on the sand's hillocks and faced the bristling dogs. Edwin arched an arrow that fell short, but Harelip, with a sling such as David carried into battle against Goliath, hurled a stone through the air that whistled from the speed of its flight. It fell squarely among the wolves and caused them to slink away towards the dark depths of the eucalyptus forest. The boys laughed and laid down again in the sand, while Grandsire sighed ponderously. He had eaten too much, and, with hand clasped on his paunch, his fingers interlaced, he resumed his meanderings. The fleeting systems lapsed like foam, he mumbled, what was evidently a quotation. That's it, foam and fleeting. All men's toil upon the planet was just so much foam. He domesticated the serviceable animals, destroyed the hostile ones, and cleared the land of its wild vegetation. And then he passed, and the flood of primordial life rolled back again, sweeping his handiwork away. The weeds and the forest inundated his fields, the beasts of prey swept over his flocks, and now there are wolves on the Cliff House beach. He was appalled by the thought. Where 4 million people disported themselves, the wild wolves roam today, and the savage progeny of our loins, with prehistoric weapons, defend themselves against the fanged despoilers. Think of it, and all because of the Scarlet Death. The adjective caught Harelip's ear. He's always saying that, he said to Edwin. What is scarlet? The scarlet of the maples can shake me like the cry of bugles going by, the old man quoted. It's red, Edwin answered the question. And you don't know it because you come from the chauffeur tribe. They never did know nothing, none of them. Scarlet is red, I know that. Red is red, ain't it? Harelip grumbled. Then what's the good of getting cocky and calling it scarlet? Grandsire, what for you do you always say so much what nobody knows? He asked. Scarlet ain't anything, but red is red. Why don't you say red then? Red is not the right word, was the reply. The plague was scarlet. The whole face and body turned scarlet in an hour's time. Don't I know? Didn't I see enough of it? And I am telling you it was scarlet because, well, because it was scarlet. There is no other word for it. Red is good enough for me, Harelip muttered obstinately. My dad calls red red, and he ought to know. He says everybody died of the Red Death. Your dad is a common fellow, descended from a common fellow, Grandsire retorted heatedly. Don't I know the beginning of the chauffeurs? Your grandsire was a chauffeur, a servant, and without education. He worked for other persons. But your grandmother was of good stock. Only the children did not take after her. Don't I remember when I first met them, catching fish at Lake Temezcal? What is education? Edwin asked. Calling Red Scarlet, Harelip sneered, then returned to the attack on Grandsire. My dad told me, and he got it from his dad afore he croaked, that your wife was a Santa Rosan, and that she was sure no account. He said she was a harshlinger before the Red Death, though I don't know what a harshlinger is. You can tell me, Edwin. But Edwin shook his head in token of ignorance. It is true, she was a waitress, Grandsire acknowledged. But she was a good woman, and your mother was her daughter. Women were very scarce in the days after the plague. She was the only wife I could find, even if she was a harshlinger, as your father calls it. But it is not nice to talk about our progenitors that way. Dad says that his wife of the first chauffeur was a lady. What's a lady? Hoo-hoo demanded. A lady's a chauffeur's squaw, was the quick reply of Harelip. The first chauffeur was Bill, a common fellow, as I said before, the old man expounded. But his wife was a lady, a great lady. Before the Scarlet Death, she was the wife of Van Warden. He was president of the Board of Industrial Magnates and was one of the dozen men who ruled America. He was worth $1,800,000,000. Coins like you have there in your pouch, Edwin. And then came the Scarlet Death, and his wife became the wife of Bill, the first chauffeur. He used to beat her too. I have seen it myself. Hoo-Hoo, lying on his stomach and idly digging his toes in the sand, cried out and investigated. First, his toenail, and next, the small hole he had dug. The other two boys joined him, excavating the sand rapidly with their hands, till there lay three skeletons exposed. Two were of adults, and the third being that of a park-grown child. The old man hudged along on the ground and peered at the find. Plague victims, he announced. That's the way they died everywhere in the last days. This must have been a family, running away from the contagion and perishing here on the Cliff House beach. What are they doing, Edwin? The question was asked in sudden dismay as Edwin, using the back of his hunting knife, began to knock out the teeth from the jaws of one of the skulls. Go on to string him, was the response. The three boys were now hard at it, and quite a knocking and hammering arose in what Grandseer babbled on unnoticed. You are true savages. Already has begun the custom of wearing human teeth. In another generation, you will be perforating your noses and ears and wearing ornaments of bone and shell. I know. The human race is doomed to sink back further and further until the primitive night where it began begins its bloody climb upwards to civilization. When we increase and feel the lack of room, we will proceed to kill one another, and then I suppose you will wear human scalp locks at your waist as well, as you, Edwin, who are the gentlest of my grandsons, have already begun with that vile pigtail. Throw it away, Edwin, boy, throw it away. What a gabble the old geezer makes, Harelip remarked, when, the teeth all extracted, they began an attempt at equal division. They were very quick and abrupt in their actions, in their speech, in their movements of hot discussion over the allotment of the choicer teeth, was truly a gabble. They spoke in monosyllables and short, jerky sentences that were more a gibberish than a language. And yet, though it ran hints of grammatical construction, and appeared vestiges of the conjunction of some superior cultures. Even the speech of Grandseer was so corrupt that were it put down literally, it would be almost so much nonsense to the reader. This, however, was when he talked with the boys. When he got into the full swing of babbling to himself, it slowly purged itself into pure English. The sentences grew longer and were enunciated with a rhythm and ease that was reminiscent of the lecture platform. Tell us about the Red Death, Grandseer, Harelip demanded, when the teeth affair had been satisfactorily concluded. The Scarlet Death, Edwin corrected. And don't walk all that funny lingo on us, Harelip went on. Talk sensible, Grandseer, like a Santa Rosan ought to talk. Other Santa Rosans don't talk like you.